to Bouchard. He got it to him. Hyman got it back to McDavid. What a move, but what a save by Thatcher Demko, who absolutely shut the door and robbed Connor McDavid.
Play-by-play there, Harn and Ryan Singh. Edmonton Oilers beat the Vancouver Canucks, but a nice save there by Thatcher Demko. The goalies have been good. What about everybody else in Vancouver? Here with that story is our good friend John Garrett, analyst for the Vancouver Canucks on Sportsnet. Cheech, how are you today? Great to hear your voice again. How you been?
I'm good. You should tell me when I'm on after Elliot, because you say 9:30, and then if I know I'm coming on after Elliot, I know it's going to be late.
Yeah, that's what happens when you get paid by the word. He likes to go Broadway on the program, and that's just fine.
But before
we get to the Vancouver Canucks, and I want to talk to you about a couple of goalie issues as well. How's your health? How are you feeling, John?
I'm good. Fortunately, I was double vaccinated. I had my second vaccination in June. So when I did get it, my symptoms were relatively mild, cough, no fever, could still taste, all those things. So I still got a nagging little cough, but other than that, I'm good. And I feel very fortunate that I didn't get grasped more by COVID like a lot of other people did.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not great news that you get it in the first place, but that it was mild is certainly terrific. The Vancouver Canucks, I'll be honest with you. I looked at the division and I said, you know what? Vancouver's going to be in there. The Vancouver Canucks are very much going to be in the conference, and they probably will be. And maybe I'm just overreacting to October. But November 1st, I did not expect to see the Vancouver Canucks in last place in the division. Lost three games in a row, albeit all by one goal, to Edmonton, Philly, and Minnesota. What happened in October, John?
I think it's pretty easy to put your finger on it because, they started the season with 6 on the road, 3-2-1 in those 6 road games. So that's not bad. But then you come home and they've lost 3 in a row at home. JT Miller has one goal. Elias Pettersson has one goal. Connor Garland, who was off to a great start and had points in the first 6 games, hasn't got a point at home. They are the worst team in the league creating 5-on-5 chances. And our good friend Thomas Drantz at The Athletic, who was so into all things statistical, keeping track of that, and created opportunities and created chances. You can't play games. They've got 4 goals in the 3 home games. And they're not the Wild game, the Philly game, and the Edmonton game. They didn't deserve to win them. They just didn't. They're the third worst team trailing this year. So you're chasing the game, and especially when your stars aren't going, it's hard to play catch-up. And they're only 9 games in. And the guys that they're counting on, and especially Elias, is really the catalyst for the power play and for creating chances in the offensive zone. And he hasn't been very good. He hasn't controlled the play. And I thought last game in the first period he looked better, but then he kind of disappeared in the last 2. So they have to get him going. So they've got a 7-game homestand. They've lost the first 3. 7-game homestand going into it, you'd like to say, okay, we're going to be 5-2. Now you've got 4 games left. The Rangers have won what? 5 of their last 6.
And Shesterkin looks great, by the way, I'm sure you've seen.
The Rangers are playing really well as a team, and Shesterkin is benefiting from that. But then they've got Nashville, Dallas, and Anaheim. So you would hope you'd catch the Rangers, beat them, and then you could win these last 4 and then head out on the road again with something positive, but they really have to get their stars going. You can't, you look around the league and teams that are getting secondary scoring and you go up and down and you say, oh, who's the hottest team in the league right now? Well, it's probably the Calgary Flames. And who's the best player? Well, Johnny Gaudreau, Matthew Tkachuk, Sean Monahan. And who's the best players? Those guys are the best players. and they're carrying the they score first almost every game. They score in the first period almost every game, and they're getting great goaltending. Well, the Canucks are getting great goaltending. Both goalies have been good.
Yeah.
But they're just not scoring.
That's one of the things I wanted to get to here, because, you know, when you talk about the Calgary Flames, I mean, Jacob Markstrom's got 3 shutouts in his last 4 games. He's been phenomenal. You can make the argument right now he might be the best goaltender in the league. But I look at the Vancouver Canucks and I say, how many games have they squandered great goaltending performances? Demko, save percentage, .924, .917 for Yaroslav Halak in the 2 games that he's played. Like, I look at some of the Vancouver games, specifically when Demko's in there, and you know this, John, goaltender yourself, when you get a great performance for your goalie, you got to make it count.
Well, and you're still in it. That's what gets me is the games Jarl played too, and Thatcher the other night against Edmonton. You know, they get ahead 2-0, and you think, okay, this one's over, and McDavid gets all those chances, and Dreisaitl gets all those chances, and yet they're still right there. And they get a power play in the 3rd period, and they can't score, and then they score with 5 seconds left and a meaningless goal, other than it just takes the embarrassment of being shut out at home away. And Brock Besser, who has been pretty good and has had the most chances of the Canucks, he scores. And I think Brock's got 2 goals this year. So you need your star players to really get going. In Colorado, when they were struggling, what happened? Well, Landeskog wasn't going and MacKinnon wasn't going. Well, yeah. Now they're going, so Colorado's going. And you go right around the league, and the teams who are playing well, it's their best players.
I know there's a lot of concern. You mentioned Elias Pettersson a couple of moments ago. I know there's a lot of concern there about the soft start, 4 points in 9 games. Is it too easy just to say, well, the contract situation, you know, missing a bunch of camp, that's gonna contribute to all? Is it too easy, John, just to say that is the reason why we're seeing a soft start from Pettersson?
Well, I think that's part of it, and missing the last 30 games last year. So you miss those, and then you come in and you're not camped to start, so you're behind. But I don't care who you are, and I don't care what kind of swagger you have. You get into a little bit of rut, and you can see it with Elias that even taking passes, that I'm absolutely amazed at when he first came to the league, and the way anything that was in within reach, he'd get it in his skates or behind him, and he'd play it off behind his back and to his forehand. And even that now, you see him missing passes. And, okay, you're holding the stick too tight, or you got a little bit of nerves. I think that right now, until he has a game or 2 games where he gets some points, and gets back into a little groove, he is playing like a player that's nervous. And I don't care what stars, Matthews and Marner and those guys in Toronto, look at their start. And people were saying, well, you know, they're just not themselves. Well, hey, their confidence was down, the team's not playing well, and it takes a little while. I don't care who you are. And you go back, Mike Bossy and Krejci and even Mario, and not very often for Wayne Gretzky, but there'd be stretches for Gretzky, especially a little bit later in his career, where he'd go 4 or 5 games without piling up some points. And I think Elias really right now is got a little confidence problem, and I know he doesn't exude that attitude, but I just watching him play and watching the little things that he is so good at, having trouble with them, I think it's a confidence thing.
Who's the best player in your estimation right now?
Who's the best player?
Outside of the goaltender, like outside of Thatcher Demko specifically, who's their best player? And is it Bo Horvat?
I would say Bo Horvat on most nights, but I'd look at Oliver Ekman-Larsson, who has been very good and used in every situation. And matched up against the other team's best lines, and I'd say it would be Oliver Ekman-Larsson.
This is a division that we looked at and we said this is going to be up for grabs. This is going to be a division that we think that, you know, the Vegas Golden Knights are going to run away with it. Edmonton's going to be in that conversation as well. And then after that, it's jump ball. And a lot of teams would be in the convo. Vegas has had, you know, they had their struggles to kick off the season. Now they've won three in a row. They're going to climb up to the top. The Calgary Flames have won six games in a row. They just owned October. We'll see what November brings for them. Edmonton is a machine as well. Like that's an offensive juggernaut. After that, it's question marks. Like, I don't know what to expect out of the San Jose Sharks, but the fact that they're, you know, playing at a 600 clip is shocking. I think we're all expecting more of a dip from Anaheim, although they're coming off a, you know, win against the Montreal Canadiens. LA is a question mark. I expected Seattle around the bottom. How good can this Vancouver Canucks team be in this division when you measure them up against the two expected heavyweights, Vegas and Edmonton? I'm going to hit pause on Calgary for a second, but against those two teams specifically, John.
Well, I look at the two games against Edmonton, and the Canucks have lost both of them, but they lost the first one in Edmonton opening night in a shootout. And then they lose 2-1 in a game that, Edmonton outplayed them, but they were right there. So I think they could match up against Edmonton, especially with Edmonton's goalie. And Mike Smith, when he's on, okay, but he's, 39 years old now and some injury problems. That you watched Mikko Koskinen in that Philadelphia game. That Edmonton's only loss of the year. And that's what I think Edmonton, the consistency in goal is going to be a problem for them. Vegas is playing better now, and they've got some injuries. When they get everybody back, Vegas is going to be good. But right now, Robin Leonard, to me, is not playing very well. They win 5-4, and again, Leonard wasn't great, but they end up getting the win in a shootout. And so I think Vegas and Edmonton would probably be the best, but Calgary is, with Darryl from the start of the season, they all play tough. They're bigger. They're stronger. I like Calgary better than Vegas right now. But
yeah, I'll tell you what, they've found some magic with Gaudreau, Lindholm, and Tkachuk. And I know everyone in the East is talking about, oh, it's the monkey off the back. No, it's a gorilla off the back of Mitch Marner, who finally scores his first goal of the season on Saturday. But hey, listen, Sean Monahan's feeling that as well. He just got his first on Saturday. And if they can get him going, and they've got a really solid line in Coleman, Backlund, and Pitlick. Again, it's early, 8 games, but they're playing a lot better than I thought they would, to be honest, John. Listen, a lot of it might just be the foundation of the goaltender. Markstrom has been great, but I'm surprised at Calgary. I really am.
Yeah, I like some of the moves they made, just getting bigger and stronger. And right now, Zadorov's not even playing.
I know.
And you add him to that mix, and they are big and strong, and their defense moved the puck, and Kelly on Saturday was showing how quickly they get the puck from defense to offense, and that's one of the things that the Canucks are talking about too, is that other than Quinn Hughes, and I think Oliver Ekman-Larsson has been good, and that's who I should have said the best player for the Canucks. I should have said Quinn Hughes instead of Oliver Ekman-Larsson. I'm taking that back. I'm going with Quinn Hughes.
Let the record show.
But that's, and teams now, that's a big part of your offense, and playing in the offensive zone is making sure that when it does get in your end, that it's quickly turned around and going the other way. And the Calgary Flames have done a great job at doing that.
They really have. John, always good catching up with you. Glad that your health is sound.
Yes, thanks. On the Kyle Beach thing, and you guys have handled it very well. And it's disappointing and it's disheartening. It's so sad to think that, you know, the players and the Players Association and the players on that team at the time, it's disappointing all the way around and so disheartening that had to happen and did happen. But yeah, for myself personally, it's even more disheartening that I thought I knew the hockey people involved, and they're friends of mine, and they're, you know, relative contemporaries of mine. Joel Canville, Kevin Cheveldayoff are the two people that I thought I knew, and I thought if they knew something like that, that they would have done something. And that, to me, that's the most disappointing thing, is that people that I thought I knew and thought would act when they saw a wrong being done like that, and that wouldn't override the humanity of the situation. And it is so sad. And hopefully the game and the culture will learn from it.
Strong words, and amen, John. Well, let me ask you this then. Really quick, we got about 90 seconds for this one. You were a player rep when you were with Hartford.
Yes, I was.
You were the player rep right now with the conference call coming up later on today, would you remove Donald Fehr as executive director?
Yes. Yes, I would. Yes, I would. I don't think there's any doubt about it now. Different era when I was the player rep, Al Nicholson was ruling with an iron fist, and it was guys like Mike Milbury and Michael Connell and people like that that finally held Al Nicholson to account. And I think now the player reps just have to say, okay, if you knew, and from everything that's been said, Donald Fehr knew what was going on and nothing happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just inexcusable.
You're a good man, John Garrett. Thank you so much for this.
Listen.
I want to say, because that's really hard for people in the industry as well. Like, these are colleagues, these are friends. Like, and that's, I know it's hard, and it probably breaks your heart to say it, but that's really brave, John. That's good for you. Good for you, John.
Well,
you're a good man.
It's sad. It is. Okay, thanks.
Awesome. John Garrett, thanks so much. John Garrett, analyst for the Vancouver Canucks on Sportsnet. The Vancouver Canucks right now mired in a three-game losing skid, but some strong words about the Kyle Beach situation, some strong words towards colleagues and friends, specifically Joel Quenneville, Kevin Cheveldayoff. Again, Cheveldayoff will speak tomorrow. Was scheduled to speak today alongside his owner, Mark Chipman, but Chipman has been suffering vertigo, and they have delayed that press conference by a day. Speaking of press conferences, the Gary Bettman press conference is coming up next. We will carry it live right here and then have full analysis with Katie Strang right afterwards. The Merrick Show continues across the Sportsnet radio network. Back to the program. Welcome to Hour 2 of the Merrick Show across the Sportsnet Radio Network. I want to thank John Garrett for stopping by, talking with the Vancouver Canucks, and also speaking openly and from the heart and unprovoked as well about the Kyle Beach situation and expressing disappointment at all involved. Specifically people that he says he thought he knew. Colleagues, Joel Quenneville, Kevin Cheveldayoff. Quenneville, now former head coach of the Florida Panthers. Kevin Cheveldayoff, still general manager of the Winnipeg Jets. We are standing by for Gary Bettman, commissioner of the NHL. Press conference scheduled for a couple of minutes from now, or actually any time now, to be honest with you. Not sure how long the commissioner is going to speak or what he is going to say, but a couple of things that we do expect. One, and this will probably be right out of the gate, we do expect the NHL to officially apologize to Kyle Beach, as he did privately. Here's NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman.
Difficult week for all of us, but not nearly as disturbing and difficult as it has been this week and since 2010 for Kyle Beach. As I told Kyle on Saturday, I am sorry for what he has been through and thought he has been courageous, especially this past week. We discussed the path forward with him involved in efforts to confront abuse. We also offered to him and his family our resources for for counseling. Before I take your questions, before Bill and I take your questions, let me review the last week from our standpoint. Until last Monday, we had not seen the report in any form. Other than the allegations in the lawsuit, we had no other knowledge, and we were awaiting the findings of the Jenner and Block investigation. We were insistent on an independent investigation, and we made clear from the outset that we could override or pursue any other course of action if we were dissatisfied on how the investigation was conducted or had reason to question its findings. The only updates that we received were on timing and process. Jenner and Block did a very thorough and professional job interviewing 139 witnesses, some multiple times, in the course of their investigation. My first task in reviewing the report late Monday and into Tuesday was to deal with the Chicago Blackhawks. Whatever you concluded from what the witnesses said, it is clear that what happened was inappropriate, it was wrong on every level, and it was not handled correctly by the Blackhawks organization. The fact that ownership was found to be unaware did not change my view that the club bore responsibility in this regard, and the club was fined as a result. People can and have debated the amount of the fine, but it was substantial by any measure and acknowledges that the organization failed to act appropriately. Also, the fine sends, as intended, a message to all clubs as to how I view their organizational responsibilities. I then turned to dealing with Joel Quenneville and Kevin Cheveldayoff. The report laid out what witnesses said, some consistent, some inconsistent on various points, but it did not draw conclusions as to credibility. Therefore, as a matter of due process, I needed to meet in person with both Quenneville and Cheveldayoff so that I could best and most fairly decide what was appropriate in terms of a league response. I met with Joel Quenneville on Thursday afternoon to discuss his view of the events of 11 years ago and wanted to make sure he felt he had a fair opportunity to tell me his account of what had happened. Ultimately, he decided it was best to resign, which, as you know from my statement on Thursday evening, is a decision with which I agreed. Should he have coached on Wednesday night? I suppose people can differ on that point, and I understand that, but he had already coached 867 games since 2010, and I wanted to make sure that no one, including Coach Quenneville, could say that I had prejudged him. Again, people can disagree on this, but I was focused on the long term, not that one game. As it relates to Kevin Cheveldayoff, I made clear on Friday that I do not believe he bore any responsibility for the club's failure to act appropriately. There seems to be some confusion, and if I was not previously clear on that, I apologize. But there seems to be some confusion on the point of whether, despite his lack of power, position, or seniority, he should have felt free to speak up. But because of his limited authority and circumstance, he left the meeting believing that this matter was going to be investigated by his bosses. And when Aldridge parted ways with the team, he thought that was what had happened. Kevin was not in a position either to be made aware of or to access additional information about what was going on after the May 23rd meeting, and he did not have such information. Having dealt with the Blackhawks, Joel Quenneville, and Kevin Cheveldayoff, I then wanted to talk to Kyle, which I did on Saturday morning. Our discussion has generally been reported on in a couple of media outlets, and I just referred to the substance of our discussion as well. Having laid out for you all that transpired in the 5 days between Tuesday and Saturday. I want to say that it is clear that in these types of matters, the NHL has made considerable progress from where it was a decade ago. Whether it is the agenda and education provided to young players at the annual rookie orientation program, league training and counseling programs, inclusion committees comprised of ownership, executives, players, fans, and young people, written policies in place on harassment and other types of inappropriate conduct that is motivated by racial, sexual, religious, or other improper biases, or a reporting hotline, all NHL personnel, whether at the league offices or with the clubs, know what is and is not acceptable and how to address matters that are not appropriate, specifically harassment, assault, discrimination, or any other activity that make the league and its 32 teams anything less than inclusive and welcoming. Ownership has been fully supportive of our efforts to move forward in this regard. In addition, if you have listened to what NHL personnel, especially the players, have been saying this past week, you know that things have been changing. Finally, in light of what has transpired in the last week, I want to make two additional points. First, I am going to seek the assistance of outside professionals to evaluate the league's efforts on these matters to make sure they are not only adequate, but also most effective. Second, while the NHL hotline is principally intended for NHL personnel, we think it is important that everyone in hockey have an outlet for help. There are many organizations that have expertise to deal with victims of abuse. Accordingly, we intend to use our resources to engage in a worldwide effort to create a network of those organizations to be available to the hockey community so that wherever you may be in the hockey ecosystem, minor league pro, major junior, college, amateur, youth, minor hockey, male or female, we think it's important that everyone has an outlet for help. Obviously, the details of the network and how it will operate will have to be worked out. And I have no doubt from your reporting on what I just said, we will hear from a number of those organizations. Again, and where I started, we could not be more sorry for the trauma that Kyle has had to endure. And our goal is to do what is necessary to continue to move forward. Bill Daly and I will take your questions.
Our first question comes from Stephen Wino of the Associated Press. Go ahead, Stephen.
Hey, Gary and Bill, in light of the entire investigation, I'm wondering, when did either of you first hear of the allegations from Kyle Beach, and did the Jenner and Block and Reed Shar ever contact either of you or anyone at the league office as part of the investigation?
So the specific allegations, the first we would have heard of the specific allegations were after the civil litigation was filed in May. And then I think there was an amended complaint getting more specific with the allegations. We were given a heads up by Chicago Council, team council, in late December with respect to a potential or threatened civil litigation, which they claimed to have looked into and to which they said there was no merit. With respect to being contacted directly by Kyle or his counsel, no, that never happened.
Thanks, Stephen. Next question comes from Josh Clipperton of the Canadian Press. Go ahead, Josh.
Gary, what was your reaction to watching Kyle Beach's interview with TSN?
My reaction was I was horrified. It was emotional. I was distressed. And I knew that he had obviously been suffering just by watching him. And I wanted to make sure that we were continued to be focused on how to deal with what was now in front of us. And I was sorry, as a personal matter, that anybody, particularly him, had to go through what he was discussing.
Thanks, Josh. Next question comes from Katie Strang of The Athletic. Go ahead, Katie.
You talked about the timing of learning of these specific allegations, but I'm curious, you know, Brad Aldrich was investigated and arrested in October of 2013, and he was convicted for criminal sexual conduct in February of 2014. When were you made aware of those, you know, actions? And when you were made aware, did you make any inquiries with the Blackhawks about the nature of his departure from the team?
So no, we wouldn't have known that, or it wouldn't have hit our radar screen until after the civil litigation was filed in May.
Thanks, Katie. Next question comes from Mark Lazarus of The Athletic. Go ahead, Mark. I believe you're muted, Mark.
Can you hear me now?
There you go.
The Coyotes obviously were docked two very high draft picks for scouting combine violations. I think it was the Devils were fined more than the Blackhawks were for cap circumvention. I know you said $2 million is substantial. It is to me. It is to a lot of us, obviously. But do you feel that that's a significant punishment to this team?
I do. The others that you refer to, different contexts, different facts. This was to make clear that the way the Blackhawks organization handled this matter was not appropriate, even though that ownership was not aware. And it was also a message to the rest of the league that you need to make sure your organization is functioning properly on these matters.
Thanks, Mark. Next question comes from Greg Wyshynski of ESPN. Go ahead, Greg.
Thanks a lot. Hey, Gary, in your conversation with Joel Quenneville and the Panthers management, was there a framework presented to him of what a potential suspension or NHL discipline would look like if he didn't resign, or some ultimatum to compel him to do so?
Well, suffice it to say that whatever conversations I had with Joel, or I suppose Vinny Viola had with Joel, Joel ultimately concluded that the most sensible course of action for him was to resign.
Thank you, Greg. Next question comes from Scott Powers of The Athletic. Go ahead, Scott.
The independent report concluded that Rocky Wirtz hadn't known, and he had said the same. Is that enough for the league, or do you plan on any investigations? Why or why not?
I've had numerous conversations with Rocky Wirtz, and I don't doubt for a moment that he had no knowledge of this. Rocky, if he did have knowledge of this, would have had the organization operate in a very different way. When you're in an organization, sometimes, depending on where you sit in the various levels, information gets filtered. It's unfortunate, and you always need to try to focus on making sure that the people that you work with understand that matters of urgency or importance, matters that challenge the value of your organization, need to rise as high as necessary to get taken care of. Based on what was in place for the Blackhawks at the time, that wasn't the case. And that's why the Blackhawks have been fined.
Thank you, Scott. Next question comes from George Richards of Florida Hockey Now. Go ahead, George. I don't see George, so let's move on. Next question comes from Pierre LeBrun of The Athletic. Go ahead, Pierre.
Gary, you mentioned the league seeking outside help to further educate yourselves in this space. Have you identified who you're going to reach out to? And if so, is Sheldon Keefe's respect group among those that you expect to reach out to?
Actually, what I believe I said is I was going to bring in some professionals to evaluate what we're doing to not only make sure it's adequate, but it's best of class. And we'll start looking for the appropriate professionals to do that in very, very short order. But obviously, we've been dealing with the more immediate questions of the week but that is something that we will focus on promptly.
Thanks, Pierre. Next question comes from Scott Burnside. Go ahead, Scott.
Perhaps for both of you, I wonder what you think it says about the culture of hockey that even though Kevin Cheveldayoff's role at the time didn't rise to a threshold that you feel deserves further sanctions, but he's been a GM for 10 years, and the fact that at no point for a decade that he thought to mention to either of you that this event happened, that he was part of a meeting where these allegations were raised. And even if he thought that his boss had taken care of, the fact that it never came up in a conversation with either of you for 10 years, do you find that troubling at all? Or what kind of message do you think that sends?
Well, first of all, he thought the matter, based on his position and the information available to him, and the fact, as I said, that Aldridge subsequently departed the organization, he thought it had been fully resolved by the people that he reported to. Kevin was such a minor player in this, and we discussed this with Reed Schar, who did the investigation for Jenner and Block, that if I have this correct, and Bill will correct me if I'm wrong, when they were doing the investigation, the only person who placed Kevin in the room for the May 13th meeting was Kevin. Everybody else either forgot or didn't acknowledge that he was there. He had been with the Blackhawks for 9 months. He was an assistant general manager with fairly limited responsibilities. This was not something that he not only had no responsibility for, that based on what was available to him in his minor relatively position at the time, he had no reason to believe that anything other than the right things were going on.
The only thing I'd add is the report did not suggest what exactly was said at that meeting. It's clear they talked about an inappropriate relationship, but the extent of that relationship and what was involved, according to several people at that meeting, was not raised. So Kevin wouldn't have had reason to know how significant an event we're talking about happened.
Thank you, Scott. Next question comes from John Mattis at The Score. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Gary. I'm hoping you can expand on Quenneville coaching after the investigation's findings were revealed, because like I'm trying to get the logic here where even optically it looks really bad for him to be coaching. You know, Kyle Beach just came out with his interview and then you see him on the bench. Can you unravel that a little bit?
Yeah, I thought I did in my statement, but I'll try it again. I knew I had to have Joel come in and I had to have a very candid conversation with him. He was entitled to due process in terms of letting me hear from him directly and judge his credibility. We were dealing with something that was 11 years previous. He had been on the bench, as I had indicated, for the past 867 games, and I didn't want him to feel that he was being prejudged in any respect. So really, while it may have optically, as you said, not been the best look, I was more concerned with the substance than the look.
Thank you, John. Next question comes from John Warrow of the AP. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, this is for either of you guys. When you refer to having a hotline set up, would it make sense for the league to have regular discussions with teams' HR departments to maybe track issues and be proactive rather than having to wait for something like this to surface and be able to warn potential future employers?
I'd say that particularly, going back two and a half years when the Bill Peters matter happened, we have instituted a reporting culture where the clubs are under no misimpression that they are obligated to report on a regular basis to the league any inappropriate conduct in the manner that we're talking about. So we think the mechanism is already in place where we hear regularly from the clubs with respect to reporting matters.
Thank you, John. Next question comes from Chris Bumbaca of USA Today. Go ahead, Chris.
Hey, Gary.
Hi.
I'm wondering, since you keep mentioning 867 games, had you known about this in 2011, would he have coached one game even?
Had we known about this in 2011, everything would have been handled differently. But we didn't, and the information as it evolved, what we know now, I don't think everybody knew when the complaint was filed. And so, yeah, obviously it would have been treated differently because we wouldn't tolerate this.
Thanks, Chris. Next question comes from Kevin Paul DuPont, the Boston Globe. Go ahead, Kevin. Let's come back to Kevin. Let's go to Mike McIntyre. Go ahead, Mike.
Gary, you mentioned with Kevin Sheveldayoff that he believed that this matter had been handled coming out of that meeting. Did you question him then about the fact that Brad Aldrich was back in some capacity with the team as that summer and even into the fall in terms of his day with the Cup and participating, and what to make of the fact that wouldn't Sheveldayoff have been aware of that and wondered how was this handled when he was still around the team?
I don't believe that they had very much interaction. Also, Kevin, again, believed that the matter had been appropriately taken care of because he wasn't aware, as Bill indicated, of what the exact nature of the allegations were relative at the time to what it ultimately came out to be. Kevin was in a position where he didn't have access to information and he had no reason to believe that what he had seen or known had any been dealt with any way other than appropriately.
Thank you, Mike. Next question comes from Gianfrancois Teotino of La Presse. Go ahead, JF.
Hi, thanks. What would you say to hockey fans and Blackhawks fans who might feel like they can't cheer for their team and the sport as openly and freely as before? Is there like any way to rebuild that trust?
I think that people are going to, like us, feel very unhappy isn't the right word, to feel dispirited, disappointed, horrified as to what happened, but understand that we've tried to be as transparent as possible, that action has been taken disciplinary to address the things that were done wrong, that we have had, even prior to this, procedures and training and counseling in effect to ensure that the culture of hockey doesn't encourage and, in fact, prohibits this type of activity. And we're going to have to be judged as we move forward. But I think if you take into account all of the factors here, while it's certainly a horrible picture, we have to move forward the best we can, doing the things that are right in terms of addressing either what's happened or how we move forward.
Thank you. Next question comes from Eric Fisher of the Sports Business Journal. Go ahead, Eric.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. Looking forward, just wanted to get a sense of any sort of concern or expectation you might have that there may be other unrelated incidents of abuse that'll come to light based on the nature of this event and how Kyle's come forward.
You know, that's an important and good question. We're dealing now with something that happened 11 years ago. If there were many more of these, I would find that horrifying. And if there were many more of these recently, I would find that horrifying. But I think we've tried to effectively ensure that hockey, particularly at the NHL level, that all personnel understand what is and isn't acceptable and how to proceed if these things happen, and hopefully they don't. Hopefully, and I believe most of our personnel are good people who do the right things. But you know, you occasionally get instances which are horrific because sometimes there are bad people doing bad things.
I think we've effectively built an effective infrastructure over the last several years, and we'll see how effective it is going forward.
Thank you, Eric. Next question comes from Cameron McIntosh of the CBC. Go ahead, Cameron.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. When you speak to experts in this space about abuse, you know, generally not just in sports, they'll say policies are great, a hotline's great, but it only is effective if people feel empowered to use it. So when we take a look at, you know, the nature of hockey and a player who's worried about their career, or a young executive, or how do we ensure that people feel empowered within their team organizations to speak out?
Well, first of all, from ownership on down, all of our personnel or all of our organizations now and have for some period of time understand what we believe is acceptable and not acceptable. And that an organization that is suppressing information of improper activity understands that ultimately there's going to be a consequence to that. The hotline, which can be administered or a report can be made anonymously so that somebody can, and it doesn't have to be the person who's affected. If you see something that you think is wrong, you can call anonymously and everything gets followed up on. And so I think what we've tried to effectuate, and you're seeing it again, you're seeing it in the players' comments, and to the extent the hotline is being utilized, people understand that there is a remedy to deal with improper acts, whether or not they witness them or they're subject to them. And that is something that we're going to continue to hammer home. And frankly, if this horrible situation should serve any constructive purpose, it's to demonstrate that this will not be tolerated. And if you have a problem in your organization, you better deal with it. And if you're in a position of authority, you shouldn't be overlooking it because there'll be a consequence to that.
Thanks, Cameron. Next question comes from Louise Radnofsky of the Wall Street Journal. Go ahead, Louise.
Hi, sorry about that. Do you feel confident that in 2011, had you known that this was a sexual encounter between a player and a coach, that one side alleged was consensual and the other side alleged was non-consensual, that the league would have handled this or the team would have handled this the way it has been handled today?
Yeah, actually, and if you go back to our original statement on Tuesday, whether or not it was, quote, consensual, the fact is when somebody in a position of authority is dealing with somebody who perceives themselves to be subordinate to that position of authority, it basically can't be consensual and is inappropriate. And I think we've been very clear about that. A subordinate can't be in an appropriate relationship with somebody who's their supervisor or is perceived to have power over them. So we would have considered that inappropriate at the time.
Thank you, Louise. Next question comes from Murat Addis of The Athletic.
Hi, guys. Just returning to the idea of Kevin Sheveldayoff and his, to your point of view, lack of knowledge, his belief that supervisors were looking into it, all those sorts of things. As I understand it, you know, Aldrich did remain with the team in the coming days. So despite them not interacting, an AGM will know who is on their staff necessarily, right? So I'm wondering, moving forward in that situation, what is a person's responsibility in a situation like that to speak up and ask questions regardless of title?
You have to look at every situation on a case-by-case basis. Kevin's principal duties at the time were the salary cap and scouting. He was not having that level of interaction. And again, remember, his boss and his boss's boss he believed were investigating and taking care of it. He had no basis to know what the conclusion was. And he was advised, I think, 3 weeks later that Aldrich was leaving the organization. He didn't know on what basis or anything else. It wasn't within the scope of his authority, which is why I had to sit with him, talk through, judge his credibility, and which is why all of these things have to be done on a case-by-case basis. Every hockey ops president, every team president, every general manager, every assistant general manager, on each club, every job description is different. So don't be completely misled by the title. I am satisfied, and I was after talking to Kevin and understanding everything that I needed to know about the situation, is what was going on was beyond anything in his world that he could deal with.
Thank you, Murat. Next question comes from Jeff Hamilton of the Winnipeg Free Press. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thank you. Gary, the basis of your decision regarding Kevin Cheveldayoff and absolving his role was strictly based on his position within the organization and spoke nothing to the moral and ethical duty we all have in speaking up and following up on these allegations, a fact that was driven home in 1996 with Sheldon Kennedy, who was a member of your league at the time when he came forward. You mentioned some reasons why, only he knew he was in the meeting. The details weren't overly specific, despite Cheveldayoff saying in the report that he understood explicitly the allegations that included unwanted advances. But with these claims of defense, are these at all based on opinions of experts in this industry of people who look after abuse?
I believe based on what was available to Kevin and what he did and did not know that he had no responsibility for this. It wasn't a question about speaking up. You know, it's not a question of values. You can't speak up and be focused on values on things you don't know about. He didn't know and he didn't have access to the information. What he did know led him to believe that it was being dealt with appropriately.
Thanks, Jeff. Next question comes from Mike Stevens of SI Hockey Now. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, this is for Gary. Could you provide any context as to why the NHL does not have a sexual misconduct policy for its players or its staff, opposed to other leagues?
We do have a sexual misconduct policy. We don't tolerate it, and we punish as appropriate. I know that there are policies in other leagues where they specify what the penalty is, but that's something that they frequently don't adhere to. We think you judge this on a case-by-case basis, and you impose the punishment that's applicable based on the facts and circumstances of a particular case. Having some sliding scale, that's not the way to measure it is. You find out what happened, and then you deal with it in a way that you believe is appropriate, understanding and making everybody understand what is tolerated and what isn't tolerated, what conduct is acceptable and what conduct is not acceptable. You want to add to that?
No.
Thank you, Mike. Next question comes from Ben Pope of the Chicago Sun-Times. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi, thank you. You mentioned that the Blackhawks first notified the NHL about potential litigation last December. Why was action not taken in the 5 months between when you found out about that and when the lawsuits were filed?
Probably primarily because of the nature of the heads up, which is there's a potential civil litigation. We've looked into the matter and there's no merit to it. That's why.
Thank you, Ben. Next question comes from Andrew Knoll of the New York Times. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, hi, gentlemen. I know you spoke a bit to ownership's awareness or unawareness. I'm wondering, in the course of your own diligence, the third-party investigation, did you determine exactly why, especially given the level of communication between senior management and ownership, this wasn't run up the chain? And are there any mechanisms in place to ensure that it is in the future?
Well, first of all, I think it's clear that senior management made the decision to not deal with this and not talk about it and not tell ownership about it. And I think this situation and the view of this that we expressed to the clubs on an ongoing basis is you need to make sure that the people that work for you do their jobs in reporting to you what needs to be done in situations that they may find difficult or distasteful. And so it's part of us making clear to the clubs, and I think I've done that without any ambiguity over the last few years. You're responsible to go what goes on. You need to know what's going on in your organization, and you need to take appropriate action when inappropriate things are taking place. And I don't, and if, I think if you go throughout the league, I don't think there's any question about that. And again, if nothing else, this has to serve as a wake-up call to all clubs that you need to make sure you understand what your organization is doing, because you're going to be held responsible.
Thank you, Andrew. Next question comes from Chris Hush, NBC Chicago. Go ahead, Chris. Chris, I believe you're muted.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Perfect. I'm sorry about that. Gary, thank you so much. This question is for you. Last week, a couple of Blackhawks players spoke to us, one of them telling us, you know, he heard rumors about this incident at the time. Of course, also last week, Kyle Beach said comments were made to him in the locker room, all around the arena, in some cases calling it bullying. Do you feel that some of these Blackhawks players who heard these rumors about Aldrich should have done more? And how are you working with them, specifically the players, not just leadership, to make sure there's accountability there as well?
Well, first of all, the report, I think, makes clear that a number of players had testified to them that they were completely unaware. Some others had said they had heard rumors. So we're not sure what players may or may not have known what. With respect to what players should or should not be tolerating, we've done a job of educating the league in terms of the hotline so that they understand that they can make a report anonymously if they choose to, if they see something that's inappropriate. But more importantly, when you see the reaction and the statements of players in particular over the last week, the players are as horrified as we are, and they don't want to see that as part of their game. They want to make sure that they and their colleagues are in a safe environment, which is something we want them to have as well. So I think the players absolutely get it.
Thank you, Chris. Next question comes from Darren Drager of TSN. Go ahead, Darren. Darren, you're muted. Darren, I believe you're still muted. You want to try? Let's try to come back to Darren. Let's go to Frank Saravalli. I'm sorry, Frank. Go ahead.
Bill, you had referred to the, quote, Bill Peters matter. Given that we're approaching two calendar years since that allegation came to light, can you shed any light for us on why that investigation has not been completed or come to a resolution?
Well, the investigation has been completed. Next steps, we're in touch with the team's representatives with respect to next steps coming from that investigation, if any. There have been no recent communications in that regard, but the investigation is done.
Thanks, Frank. Next question comes from, I think Darren's mic is working now. Go ahead, Darren Drager. Apparently not. Okay, let's go to Lane Higgins from the Wall Street Journal. Go ahead, Lane.
Hey there. Thanks for holding this. Just one question, given that a lot of the individuals that were involved in the specific case for the Blackhawks also have an affiliation with USA Hockey. Do you see a role for the U.S. Center for Safe Sport to get involved here, given that, you know, some of the leagues or some of the individuals that do have affiliations with USA Hockey have already been punished by the league?
Potentially, and that's a discussion we're going to have to have.
Yeah, something more for the U.S. Center for Safe Sport and USA Hockey than necessarily us, but certainly we're there to be helpful to the extent anything in that direction is appropriate.
Thanks, Lane. We have a follow-up question from Mark Lazarus. Go ahead, Mark.
Gary, over the last, you know, decade plus, John McDonough was always praised for having kind of the model franchise. Does this make you rethink of how closely you need to pay attention to the office cultures within these teams, these organizations, and how they're really running things?
I think we tend to be very close to our clubs, ownership, senior executives. We have regular interaction. I was very surprised when I read the report and how it focused on John McDonagh. And my guess is, and I'm not trying to push this back, you've been close to the club and you had a lot of interaction with John McDonagh, and I assume you're as surprised as I am.
Thank you, Mark. A follow-up from Pierre LeBrun. Go ahead, Pierre.
Yeah, guys, I'm also hoping that my colleague Rick Westhead will get a question on this call. But in the meantime, a follow-up to my first question. I spoke with Sheldon Kennedy today, and you know, one of the things that surprised me is that he has not heard, he said, from the league over the years, given his work in this space. He said the same thing about the PA. And I was curious, as again, Gary, you stressed the desire to, you know, to further educate for the league on this. Would you reach out to Sheldon Kennedy at some point, given his work over the years in this?
We're going to reach out to anybody who's interested in working with us. You know, Sheldon's terrible experience was not at the NHL level. We've been focused on what we have to do for the NHL players and personnel. But certainly if Sheldon has an interest in working with us, particularly as we seek to set up a network that can provide access for anybody involved at hockey at any level, we would be more than welcome to work with him and have his input.
Thanks, Pierre. We have a follow-up from Scott Burnside. Go ahead, Scott.
Thank you. Just two quick ones on the network that you just spoke about, Gary, and whether it's an investigation, but the look into how the NHL has handled this and is handling all these issues. Do you have a timeline for the network and being able to give, you know, sort of more details on how it works, who's involved, and also in terms of the look into the NHL, will you make those findings public?
Well, first of all, we're not going to do an internal investigation. What we're going to do is bring in professionals to make sure that the resources that we have and are devoting to this are adequate and what we can do that may be better. We think we've done a lot. I went through the list of things that have been put in place long before this. And I believe, particularly as you're seeing the culture of the game having changed over the years and continuing to change, I think we're probably right now in a better place than we've ever been. I just want to make sure it's good enough and that we can't do better. With respect to the other network, I want to make sure there's a structure in place that people, no matter who they are, where they are, and in what level of hockey they're involved in, they have a place that they can access quickly by putting together the existing organizations that have the expertise in this in a network that connects people in our game at all levels closer to these resources. And that's something we're going to move forward on as prudently and as practically and as quickly as possible.
At this point, it starts with the NHL hotline and the how we're getting reported to. And we're going to work with the other hockey organizations who we have good relationships with, you know, down to the junior level, down to the minor hockey level, and other professional leagues as well, to make sure that there's a resource available for all players in need.
Next question comes from Chris Bumbaca of USA Today. Go ahead, Chris.
Bill, I know that no team might be looking to hire Stan Bowman and anybody else related to this anytime soon, but have you considered any future punishment or banishment for any of the players involved? And what would that look like?
I think the answer to that is those that needed to be separated from the game have been separated from the game. If there's a point in the future where any of them are interested in coming back and there's a club in having them, then we'll have to evaluate that. I'll have to evaluate that at the time, taking into account all the facts and circumstances as we then know, including what may have transpired since the separation to that particular point in time. Nobody's been made any promises, if that's what you're asking. Absolutely not. And I'm not sure, as I sit here today, how I would react at some point in the future to a request to come back.
Thank you, Chris. Next question comes from Rick Westhead of TSN. Go ahead, Rick. Rick, I believe you're muted.
Apologies. Gary, I've got a question and a quick follow-up, if you'd allow me. I understand in your call with Kyle Beach and his attorney on Saturday that you assured them that Kyle and his family would have us, you know, counseling for as long as is needed because of this. And I wonder if right now you're publicly willing to make the same commitment to the boy who was abused by Brad Aldrich in 2013 and to his family.
I would have to know more about that circumstance. I'm more focused because of the circumstances in front of us on what happened in the NHL environment. I certainly wouldn't rule it out. I certainly would need to know more information. Having said that, making our resources available is something that I would probably, not even knowing all the facts, want to do, but I think I'd need to know more before I could make the type of blanket commitment you're asking me for.
Can you tell me, Gary, whether the NHL supports the Chicago Blackhawks' attempts now, even after the team's apology, to dismiss the lawsuits that have been filed by Kyle Beach and the former high school hockey player?
What you're asking us to do is make a judgment on the legalities in a lawsuit with respect to what may or may not have happened here. And I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment on whether or not the lawsuit has merit, which is really what you're asking me to do. I did hear Danny Wirtz say on Tuesday that they would be interested in trying to resolve this and settle it, but whether or not they should be proceeding with their legal options and determine ultimately under the legal standards whether or not this is a meritorious lawsuit, that's for the lawyers involved to decide.
Thanks, Rick. We have time for about three more. Let's go to Scott Billick of the Winnipeg Sun. Go ahead, Scott.
Thanks. Gary, I think there seems to be some confusion here. So when it comes to Kevin Cheveldayoff's role in this, did he know something differently? Was he told something differently than the other six guys in that meeting? Or like you kind of absolved him of what he knew or what his role was, but what was shared in that meeting then that was different for him than it wasn't for the other guys?
Well, there are differing recollections as to what took place in that meeting. I think that what's clear is the only speaking part that I think Kevin had is they asked him if he knew anything about it, and he said no. And he left that meeting believing it was going to be taken care of by his bosses. And that is my best judgment based on what I've taken away from the report and my conversation with Kevin. And as I've said, and I said in the release, I wasn't going to paint everybody with the same broad brush because not everybody was in the same circumstance and situation. And I think it would have been, listen, the easiest thing would have been to simply impose punishment on Kevin or maybe have Kevin in a position where he thought he might want to resign. But I didn't think that would be fair or appropriate under the circumstances. People may differ with that, but that's the judgment I had to make, and that's the judgment I did make.
Thank you, Scott. Next question comes from Kevin DuPont of the Boston Globe. Go ahead, Kevin.
Thank you, John. Two-part question, if I can, Gary. We know you've spoken with Mr. Quenneville and Mr. Cheveldayoff. Have you spoken with, in this 4 or 5 day timeline, with Mr. Bowman or Mr. McIsaac or Mr. McDonough?
I have not.
Okay. Of those of whom you've spoken or whom you've spoken to, do any of them dispute the facts as presented by Kyle Beach?
I'm not sure that everybody's recollection is identical. Having said that, everybody understands, certainly in retrospect, that what transpired was inappropriate and that there were certain consequences that obviously had to follow from that. I don't think there's any dispute on that.
Thanks, Kevin. We have time for one more. Luke Fox of Sportsnet. Go ahead, Luke.
Hi, Gary. I'm just wondering, from the time you first heard of these allegations, what, if anything, do you wish you had done differently or faster in handling this case?
Well, I'm not sure that there's anything we could have done differently or faster based on the knowledge that we have. In retrospect, based on the knowledge that everybody has, I wish we knew about this in 2011, but we didn't. And what we may have thought the club was telling us, or the club thought the situation was before the lawsuit was actually filed, and what ultimately it turned out to be from the report, that wasn't this. And so in terms of the knowledge that was available, I think we, particularly in the last week, have done what was appropriate on a timely basis. You know, when you're in a public-facing organization, and I'm not just talking about the league or the clubs, any public-facing organization, there are times when people make allegations. Some have merit, some don't, and you have to try, based on the information available, to parse through it and make judgments. Obviously, when this matter got to the point that a complaint was filed and an attorney put his or her name on it, it changes the whole dynamic in terms of what is real and what is something that you have to focus on more specifically and take seriously. But in terms of how this played out and what the timelines were, I'm not sure what we could have done that would have been any different. I wish that weren't the case, because obviously having this linger over more than a decade wasn't good for anybody.
Thank you, Luke. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. A recording of this media availability will be posted on the NHL.
Okay, so that is the Gary Bettman, Bill Daly press conference on the Chicago Blackhawks, Kyle Beach and Brad Aldrich situation. We're out of time on this program, but this conversation very much does continue on our website at sportsnet.ca, the Sportsnet app as well, and certainly Sportsnet on television. We'll have plenty more on this on tomorrow's episode of the Jeff Merrick Show, with a full analysis from Elliot Friedman and other guests as well. In the meantime, the NHL, Gary Bettman apologizing to Kyle Beach, saying what happened was inappropriate. It was wrong on every level, not handled correctly by the Blackhawks organization. A lot of this press conference, again, always concerned and interested in who knew what when. But a lot of this, a lot of the questioning around it seemed to revolve around why Kevin Cheveldayoff, Winnipeg Jets general manager, has escaped any discipline or any culpability in the situation where someone like Stan Bowman or Joel Quenneville did. Kevin Cheveldayoff will speak alongside Mark Chipman, who is the owner of the Winnipeg Jets, tomorrow. We'll talk about that on tomorrow's edition of this show. And also, don't forget, a little bit later on today, there'll be an executive board meeting of the NHL's Players Association when, amongst other things, we believe the fate of Donald Fehr, executive director of the PA, may be decided. There was a lot in that one, and I know a lot of it was unsettling. This whole story is unsettling and has opened nerves. And these wounds are very much open and won't heal for a while, certainly for Kyle Beach and certainly for a lot of people listening, a lot of people following it as well. The story is nowhere close to being over. We will continue to stay on it and document all of it here on this show and elsewhere at Sportsnet. In the meantime, we encourage you to stay tuned to our various platforms for the very latest and to follow Elliot Friedman specifically on Twitter. We'll be covering this on the podcast we record tonight and on Sportsnet Central this evening and also on this program tomorrow. Thanks for joining me today on the Jeff Merrick Show. We're back tomorrow at noon Eastern, 9 Pacific.